nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, thanks for coming. My name is Betash Behinayin. I work with Professor Supriya Datta and I'm a PhD student. So let me give you a short background about me, scientifically what I've been doing through my PhD. So in the past 20 years or so, there has been a lot of progress made in a field broadly called spintronics. For example, the GMR effect has been a very good successful story. This is this giant magnetoresistance in which for a, you have a spin valve device. This is a vertical device having two magnetic contacts with some polarization and a spacer region which could be metallic or a tunnel oxide. And the resistance of this device changes as you change the relative polarization of these two magnets. So if the magnets are parallel, you get some certain amount of resistance, and if they're anti-parallel, you get a different resistance. That way you can encode information, and that is in fact at work in the hard disks of our computers, and it won the Nobel Prize a few years back. In terms of lateral structures, something like that, there has also been a lot of progress made, both in metals and semiconductors, different materials. There are dozens of experiments where people inject the spins from a ferromagnetic contact into a channel and measure the spin signal elsewhere using another magnet. Now, in our group, what we, work on heavy duty is this non-equilibrium Green's function formalism, where we can treat and find these current voltage characteristics for low-dimensional structures, whether they are spin-polarized or not. More recently, we have been working on the interaction of those itinerant spins or electrons with localized spins. So as these itinerant electrons are passing by, they can affect the dynamics of some localized spin, and in turn, the dynamic that dynamics of localized spin or that magnetization would affect the spin current. So broadly speaking, what I mean by localized spin, you can categorize it into three subcategories. On the two ends of the spectrum of these non-interacting cases and these strongly interacting cases, in the non-interacting case, you have a bunch of spins described by this Bloch equation. What the Bloch equation is that anytime you have a magnetic field and a quantum spin with some degree from it, this spin starts rotating around it. That's what they call this Larmor precession. And then you could have different dephasing mechanisms. So Bloch equation uses that Larmor precession and then, puts in by ad hoc terms T1, T2 relaxation times and finds the dynamics of non-interacting spins. In terms of strongly interacting spins, which essentially gives rise to a magnet, all of these net spins get locked together so that you have a giant spin called the magnet. That dynamics is described by this Landau-Lipschitz-Gilbert equation, and in between the two is the more, the hardest case, and that's this interacting cases, where you have a bunch of spins that are not locked together, and they're not completely independent either. So to describe that exactly, one needs to go to this generalized Fock space that people call, and this is the hardest one, both computationally and conceptually. Computationally, it's difficult because you have matrices like Hamiltonians that describes the interactions of these particles or spins, and the size of that matrix increases as 2 to the power of n, where n is the number. And the 2 refers to this spin up and spin down. It is also conceptually difficult because one has to take care of all these pairwise interactions between different spins. That's something difficult to do. Usually people do some approximations based on mean field theory. Now, in the past couple of years, I've been working on this all-spin logic devices, and that's what I'll be talking about today. So, why all-spin? After all, we have electronic circuits which do the computation. Well, our computers have become more and more powerful, basically by being able to put more transistors per unit area. Okay, as we can put more transistors per unit area, we have more elements to do computation with. So that way the computer gets more powerful. I should also mention that as the sizes shrink, transistors have becoming faster and faster as well. However, this upward trend is now believed to come to an end because of one major reason, essentially, and that's power dissipation, which roughly nowadays is hovering around 100 watts. And as you can imagine, if you were to put 10 times as many transistors in the same area, the 100 watts, and not manage power dissipation, the 100 watts would become 1,000 watts. That's equivalent of a rocket nozzle, so it's unmanageable. And at this time, there is a lot of interest to try to manage this power dissipation. So ideally, you would like to have, same amount of computation done with, 10 watts of power. So we would like to look at alternative technologies, you know, to see whether, you know, there can be a dip or something like that, so that the upward trends, you know, can continue. So in the next slide, I will try to connect to this 100 watts of power and then say why all spin. Now, so the way a transistor switch is that you charge and discharge a capacitor. You put some electrons on a capacitor, or you know, there are some charges on a capacitor, and you remove those electrons. Nowadays, usually the number of electrons involved in this switching process is around 10,000. And each electron, as it switches or it goes over an energy barrier, it dissipates an energy roughly on the order of this barrier height. You see, any switch needs to have a barrier, because the switch has these two states, all right? And if there is no energy barrier in between, well, thermal fluctuations will just wobble it back and forth. So you need a well-defined barrier to separate these two states. And as you're doing the switching, charges are essentially going from one state to the other, but there are about 10,000 charges. Now, the energy that it's, you know, involved in switching a capacitor is this total charge Q times the voltage at which the transistor switches. Now, nowadays the transistor switch roughly around 1 volt. The charge of an electron is about 10 to the minus 19 coulomb. I'm not being worried about the difference between 1 and 1.6. And so this gives about 10 to the minus 19 joules together, which is about 1 electron volt. And 1 electron volt is about 40 kT. So that's where the 40 kT is coming from. And how high this needs to be, well, it depends on that, you know, how well you want your switch to act, how reliable you want your switch to be. These two states, you know, very well separated from each other. And so if you multiply these numbers, you come up with this 10 to the minus 15 joules, or 1 femtojoule per switch. Now, back of the envelope calculation, where does that 100 watts coming from? Well, 1 femtojoule times 10 to the 19 hertz, because every, you know, each switch switches about once every nanosecond in our computers. So that gives us about 1 microwatts of power dissipation per switch. There are about a billion transistors in a circuit, but not all switch at the same time. Only about 10% switch at the same time. So if you multiply the numbers, you get 100 watts. But that is all, you know, it starts from coming here and having this 40 kT, and then the number 10,000 in front, which is the number of electrons involved. A magnet, however, acts differently. And this is where our theoretical analysis, what it shows us is that, okay, so this is essentially the energy landscape of a magnet. It has two stable states, two different directions. You can assign binary data to do these two different directions. And what our analysis shows, theoretical analysis shows, is that the energy involved in switching the magnet is roughly on the order of its barrier height. But the magnet could be composed of thousands or millions of spins, but they are all locked together. So at the end of the day, you don't have this number N in front. Now, having said that, experimentally, that is not observed. What is observed experimentally is this number here for switching a magnet. And they have analyzed those experiments. It seems that there's a lot of energy getting dissipated in series resistances. And a lot of people in the MRAM industry and the researchers in the universities are working on trying to reduce this number. It has already been improved already compared to a couple of years or a few years back. So we have a magnet that can represent binary data, but that is so far from something that can do logic. So in a nutshell, let me try to explain what this is about.
You can make it do an inverting or a knock operation. Both of these effects have been observed experimentally in metals, but usually in the experiments, one magnet is fixed and one magnet is free, meaning that one of them is hard to switch, the other one is easy to switch. For logic applications, the input and output need to be the same. Why? Because each output needs to be an input to the next stage. So, basically what we're proposing is an on-spin logic device where information is in the state of a magnet, and the magnets communicate with each other with spin. And the state of the magnet is described by this, you know, spin pole phenomena, which is the interaction of a spin polarized current with a magnetic contact. So that's what my rest of my talk is going about this type of thing. Now, so we are talking about a logic device. So what requirements does a logic device need to have? Not every glitch is a logic device. So there are these essential characteristics for which you have to have, you know, any logic device has to have, from which you can make electronic circuits. I mean, it's not about performance. You cannot even do computation without this part. What I plan to do in the next few slides is to go through all these, explain them shortly or briefly, and then say how the all-spin logic device satisfies these requirements one by one. Nonlinearity is essentially what, you know, provides error correction and what distinguishes digital computing from analog computing. Let's see what it does. It's all about error correction. So let's focus on this nonlinear characteristic here, this solid here, and these are, you know, the transfer characteristic, output signal versus input signal. Now, ideally, you want your input signal, for example, if it is to represent one, ideally, you want your input signal to be exactly at this one value, you know, the perfect one. Sure enough, it doesn't happen in practice, and you have some error, so you could end up somewhere in this region, all right, not at one. So for the sake of discussion, let's say it's somewhere here. What does this transfer characteristic nonlinear one do? Well, it takes this uncertainty and makes it less certain. Because after you do this switching and you have this transfer characteristic, your signal ends up being closer to one. So you have some correction involved here. And as you feed this output signal as an input to the next stage, it even gets better and better. Now, however, if you were to do that with some linear analog type of computation, your error would just get transferred to the output signal. And then what would happen is that you make this output signal an input to the next stage, so the errors would accumulate. And after a while, you wouldn't have any signal, or it would be erroneous, meaning that one eventually could become even a zero. Now, the way the all-spin logic device performs this error correction is inherently built into the magnets, because magnets have only two stable states. So what happens is that you have this analog spin signal in the channel, but there could be uncertainties in it. 60 spins could be looking this way, 40 spins could be looking that way. But after you switch the magnet, you have a perfect digital one, digital logic one or digital logic zero, which then you can use reliably for your next stage of computation. Next one is gain, and that has to do with this idea that while you want to perform a, you know, switching action, but then there are two knobs to that. One is the information and the other one is energy. So the information comes from the input logic bit, but the energy needs to come from an independent entity, which is this power supply. Because for switching, one needs energy. And the way that it's, you know, done for the all-spin logic device is that information is in the magnet, but the energy is coming from a separate entity, which is this V supply, which could be tied to a battery. You see, for example, one could use the stray field, the magnetic field emanating from this magnet, to switch the other one. You could use that in principle. But then this magnet needs to be a lot bigger than this one, because if they are the same strength, one would not switch the other one. One has to be big to switch that one. Well, you want to make a secret out of that, when the next one has to be smaller than this one. So you have 1 billion devices, all with different characteristics, and that's hopeless. So that's where information comes from the input magnet, but the energy is not coming from the input magnet. So that's this idea of gain, and gain ensures that your signal levels are, you know, proper throughout the entire circuit. So next one is this feedback prevention. It has to do with the fact that the switching action needs to be non-reciprocal. Input should determine the state of the output, but not vice versa. Now, this is where we believe what I'm about to say is correct and it should work, but it has not been experimentally demonstrated. And that's based on this idea of a spin injection into semiconductors, where if you have a tunnel barrier, this thing represents a tunnel barrier, the spin injection efficiency improves. That has been shown experimentally. But if you don't have a tunnel barrier, the spin injection efficiency is very poor. So what's happening is that on the input magnet side, we have a tunnel barrier, which increases the spin injection efficiency, but on the output side, we don't have one. So that prevents the back injection of spins, polarized spins in the direction of that output magnet. What that does is that your spin signal in the channel is predominantly determined by the input magnet. So this channel is, at the end of the day, acting as a one-way channel, not a two-way channel. As I said, this has not been experimentally demonstrated, but Slonczewski also has a statement in one of his papers to this effect that if you have two magnets with two different polarizations on their interface, one could feed a higher torque than the other one. You see, if you are switching these magnets with torque, and what the statement says is that the magnet with, you know, lower spin injection feels a higher torque than the other. Alright, so the next one is Boolean logic. Like, that's kind of obvious that we need this because we need to do arithmetical operation and we need gates to do that. Now, what is a minimal set? A minimal set is a set from which you can make all sorts of complicated mathematical functionalities. It turns out that if you can do this unary operator NOT and a binary operator like an AND gate or an OR gate, then you have that minimal set, which is complete. You can combine the two to make a NAND gate or an OR gate, which is then a universal gate. Quickly, let me go through this truth table. There are two inputs and one output. For For the AND gate, if both inputs are 1 or high, the output would be 1, else the output would be 0. For the OR gate, if either one of them, either or one of them, is 1, the output would be 1, else the output would be 0. So what I would like to show is that how we would construct gates out of this Allspin logic device. So for magnets, let's focus on these two inputs. There are two inputs, one output. Let's forget that one for now. And the direction of the magnets represents the binary data, 0 or 1. So 0 or 1, you can assign whatever, you know, convention you want. You could call this 0 and then that one 1. And what is at work here is the inversion, meaning that based on the polarity of the supply, you could send the inversion of the magnet information into the channel. So based on just the polarity of the voltage, the spin signal would be opposite to that or the same as that. So we are using that inversion idea. So if both inputs are 0, the output goes to 1. If both inputs are 1, the output goes to 0. But what happens if one is 0 and the other is 1, where it's indeterministic? Because the signal sent from these two inputs cancel each other. So that's where this fixed input is coming in to break the tie between the two. So that's this fixed input. So you put that input, you assign it a 0 or a 1. But if you assign it a 0, you break the tie between these two and you end up with a 1. So depending on how you align this fixed magnet between 0 or 1, you can get a NAND functionality or a NOR functionality out of that. Now, this is the brute force way of doing logic. One nice idea, and this is where we are working with Professor Roy's group as well, is to work on functional gates, meaning that instead of making NAND gates and NOR gates, you align magnets in different way and, you know, put them on channel different way, so that the architecture itself performs a more complicated functionality. For example, a full adder, not just going for two NAND gates and NOR gates, just making a full, you know, adder from the get-go. All right, so these essential characteristics were not in any particular order, but I said compatibility for last because it has a special connection to spintronics. What is compatibility? Well, you have input data bit and then output data bit. What compatibility means is that they need to be on the, you know, same physical form and range. So this is kind of simple. You have a transfer characteristic. Your input is optical. Your output needs also to be optical. Why? Because the output needs to be an input to the next stage. If it's electrical, for example, if the input is electrical and the output is optical, well, that needs to be an input to the next stage. So you have to convert that optical information into electrical so that it can be an input to the next stage. So that's one, and the other one is the range. Again, that has to do with the fact that you need to cascade gates. Well, if the input range is between 0 to 1 volt and the output range is between 0 to 1 millivolt, well, that's hopeless. Because that 0 to 1 millivolt needs to be an input to the next stage, but the input needs to be between 0 and 1 volt, so that's not going to work that way. So one would have to amplify that signal to be able to use it as an input to the next stage. So in the past 10 years or so, there have been a lot of spintronics experiments and proposals for logic applications. Typically what they do is that, the idea is let's do some logic, inversion and or something, based on a spin state variable, which can then connect to another gate that does some sort of same thing. But the way these two gates connect to each other is that you convert to charge state variable. For example, you read the magnetic resistance across a spin bound structure. So magnetic resistance changes the current amplitude. So that's charge state information. And then you feed it, you use that middle circuitry and feed it to the next gate. Now, with the spintronics especially, the spin signals are, small, 10 microvolts, 20 microvolts. So you also need to amplify. So there are these two problems. You have to do this spin charge conversion repeatedly, and then you also have to amplify this signal. So this is where the all-spin scheme is, bypassing this. There has been this criticism that what can you do with 10 microvolt, 20 microvolt of a spin signal? You can do no use with it. I mean, you have to always amplify it. But experimental fact is that you can use that 20 microvolt of signal to switch a magnet. Now, if you can do that, you can switch an output magnet according to an input magnet and just use that as an input to the next stage. So it's essentially making spintronics concatenable or cascadable, because your input is magnetization, output is magnetization, that you directly feed into the next one. So you don't have to go to the charge state variable. You can directly do it all with the spin state variable. Okay, so till now I've described one logic device that can satisfy all these five requirements. I want to say something about the channel. So what this is about the channel material and the spin signal in the interconnect. water channel. Now, switching from a ferromagnet into a semiconductor is usually problematic. Why do we want semiconductors? Well, because they usually exhibit higher spin coherence length as compared to metals, and you would like to have a long range of, you know, as long as range of the communication as possible. So one would like to use semiconductors, but then the spin injection efficiency is low, and you are not sure if the spin signal in the channel would be strong to switch an output like this. They have done it with metals. With metallic channels, people have switched magnets, but with semiconductors, it has not been done. So I'm now trying to present an alternative scheme to do this switching. Heretofore, the way switching was happening is that this spin signal in the channel was providing both information and energy. So we were switching a magnet between a state A and C. So this is a 0 to 180 degrees between a state A and C by overcoming an energy barrier in between. So the spin signal was actually switching the magnet, which would involve this overcoming this energy barrier in between. Now, instead, if through other means the magnet was put at top of this energy barrier, through other means, then all the spin signal has to do at that moment is just to tip it over to the other side. And you can see that would be an easier thing to do for the spin signal. So this is what this vertical structure is about. There is this permanently fixed magnet. You apply voltage and it, you know, accumulate spins in that direction on top of this output magnet. So what that does is that it drives this magnet to this state B. So these double arrows represent this states A and C, 0 to 180 degrees, and this is at 90 degrees. So applying that voltage pulse would put this magnet on top of this energy barrier, and then all the spin signal has to do is just to tip it over to the other side. Now, this structure is almost complete. For logic applications, you have to use this cloning idea, meaning that structurally input and output cannot be different because this output needs to be an input to the next stage. This is where the input structure has to be the same, but what distinguishes what is input and what is output is the voltage pulses or biases that are applied to these structures. Now, let me say a few words about this switching mechanism I just described. Now, the basic idea was proposed by Charles Bennett at IBM a long time ago using ordinary magnetic fields, and it has been used by different authors in different contexts. With ordinary magnetic fields, it has been shown with, you know, MTCA circuits. Now, with spin torque, however, this has not been shown, and that's what I try to, you know, in the next few slides, I'm trying to convey that it's possible to do that with spin torque as well. What makes the analysis difficult with the spin torque is this. Usually, I mean, the way an ordinary magnetic field switches a magnet is that you apply the magnetic field in some direction, that certain direction becomes the minimum of energy, and the magnet just goes to its minimum of energy. Even this represents an internal field of a magnet. So you put the magnetization here, but the magnet just falls down to that minimum of energy. And essentially what the ordinary magnetic field does is that it deflects its energy landscape. With the spin torque, however, this analysis is far more difficult because you cannot do an energetics analysis, basically because the spin torque has a non-conservative nature. So one would have to totally rely on dynamics, but you can do a dynamics analysis and find whether or not you can do this switching. And that's what I've tried to show here. So this vertical axis is the component of magnetization along this from 0 to 180 degrees. And the important thing is here is are these plateaus. So I have two pulses here, V supply and V bias. And but where the plateau ends up being, whether it's in the upper half or the lower half, that totally depends on the spin signal in the channel. So essentially, the two plateaus are representing, you know, one thing here, and the other represents this magnet being stabilized here. That's what I was trying to say. The vertical one puts the magnet on top of this barrier, but the bias signal puts it either on the left or on the right. And then as you turn off these pulses, the internal field of the magnet will just relax the magnet to the state 1 or 0. There are four because I'm just considering different cases. Now, there is an issue with what I just said, because this was a particular simulation, and it was a simulation. So there are two points. One is that whether this was a singularity. Does this just happen for the particular set of parameters that I use, or is it a little more general? That's point number one. Point number two is that all those parameters that were chosen have anything to do with the experimental circumstances? Can they be achieved? So that's what the next few slides will be about. I try to convey those two points. But since this type of switching that I've been talking about has not, you know, is not experimental yet, has not been demonstrated, I'm trying to connect to the existing experimental data by comparing to another type of switching, which is just switching between A and C. So A and C switching has been observed, but going to B and then going to C has not been observed. So just to, you know, explain this. So there is a single pass switching where you just go from this state, you flip the map, you go from this state to the other state. But then what we are talking about is going through a mid state. Alright, so these are these two cases that we want to study. And to study it more generally, we are going to this switching phase diagram. Now, I'm not going to go through a lot of detail, but basic fact is that you have a spin valve structure, you apply voltage across it, and then there are certain effective fields exerted on this magnet due to a spin torque. So there's a voltage applied, and you get two different fields, alright? It comes with this field-like term and a Stan-Chu-Sweet term, which are essentially what rotate the magnet. These two fields are the knobs that rotate the magnet. Now, and then what we are asking the question in this simulation, the question we are asking is that whether, you know, by application of these two fields, whether the magnet switches or not. So if it doesn't switch, it produces a grid point on this phase diagram. But if it doesn't switch, but if it switches, it produces a white grid point on this phase diagram. So what is happening is that each grid point on this diagram represents a simulation like that. You do the simulation, you apply these fields, you see whether or not the magnet switches. Now, the white area shows the regions for which the switching is successful, and very recently people have measured the spin torque, and this is a data point from experiments, and as you can see, the experimental data point agrees well with our model. So that's what has been observed. If we do the same exercise for this type of switching, we see that there is an entire range for which the switching can be successful. Of course, there's a black region, but the white region represents the cases for which switching can be successful, and what's not trivial is that you actually, on this axis, need more field or more torque to switch the magnet. Again, I'm not going to go through the details of that, but that can also be reduced by proper magnet design. Okay, so what I just described about this two-pulse switching mechanism, where one pulse was providing this energy, that's why it's called supply, to switch the magnet, putting it on top of the barrier, and the spin signal in the channel would just tip it over one way or the other, to determine the state of the output magnet. Now, as I said, the input structure and the output structure are exactly similar. So the way you distinguish between input and output is by, you know, clocking these different voltages. So by having different voltage levels, you determine what acts as an input and what acts as an output. So this way, the information can be, you know, clocked and passed through one gate to the other gate just by clocking. So what I mean by that is that if you apply V supply and ground like that, this structure acts as an output, right? So it has gain and it can be switched. But if you apply this set of pulses, it will act as an input. What I mean by input and output is this. Like, for example, this is gate A and gate B, right? Let's focus on gate A. So this gate is doing some computation. So how does it do it? Well, the inputs are sending the information and the output is receiving that information. And the way we are doing that is by setting these voltage signals like so. And so every single device goes through a clocking scheme like that. That it acts as an output with these voltages, it receives the information, but now that it has the information, it has to send it to the next guy. So what happens is that then it would, you know, go to a send mode operation and send it to the next one. So this is what I'm trying to convey the information, and this is how you would do computation and transfer a signal from one gate to the next. Quickly, let me just also say a few words about the other clocking scheme. I had two devices, right? This is the modification of the other one. This other one was a simpler one, which didn't have these two pulses. That also could have a send and receive mode. This is a little simpler, because for that one, for this one, the send mode just means that you apply supply voltage here, and that's just nothing. Sitting there by itself, and it this receives the information. So again, these are the same gates and they're cascaded in the same fashion, but the way the signal transfers is that, okay, so to an input you are sending an information, but then let me go through this way. If you look at V2 here, this is receiving information, but then the V1 is sending the information. But after V2, this magnet has received its information, it now wants to send its information to the next card, so it goes to a send mode. So this is how the signal with these pulse trends can get transferred from one magnet to the next. So So I talked about this logic device that can flip the output and flip the magnetization of an output magnet, that point to an input magnet, which is like a, you know, logic operation. We talked about how the device would satisfy these essential characteristics. And once you have this device where you can make gate promise, then the next issue would be cascading and clocking gates. Cascading and clocking gates, we can make a, you know, entire very large scale circuit out of that. And that's what I described on the last two slides. So at this time, I would like to end the talk and thank you all for listening and open it for any questions.
You mentioned something about gain. So your gain is transconductance dependent.
That's it.
And you didn't talk about how spin affects the transconductance, because then it affects your intrinsic cutoff frequency too as well.
Well, yeah, okay. So what we mean by gain in terms of that essential requirement? So, you know, sometimes, I mean, it depends on what you call gain. Sometimes you can even call the slope of this solid curve as gain, being gain of one, things like that. But what we mean by gain is essentially the energy needed for switching. Because, what is meant by gain is that you want to do a switching action and you need an energy to do that. Without that energy, you cannot do that. That's how we are defining gain. Rather than like scope of a, you know, characteristic. So by gain, I mean that, okay, so you want to do this switching process, you need to have energy to do that, and that's what we mean by gain. And the way gain was provided by this Walter supply. So, am I making sense, or is this? Another way you could look at this is looking at this landscape of a magnet. I mean, it's pretty clear in the case of the two-pass switching. It's easy to convey. So what's happening is that the other one pulse is putting it on top of here. So that's a lot of gain. You put it on top, and then your signal needs to be very small. So usually what gain does is that it gets a small signal and gives you a stronger signal. So the way it's happening, for example, for the two-pass case, is easy to see. The supply guy puts it on top of the barrier. But then the small signal in the channel just gets lower the value. So this is why I try to describe gain in the context of energy coming from some independent source and the information coming from an input magnet. But that type of gain we have not defined here to answer the question.
And why do you have to talk about dynamic power and static power? Because that's right. The most important thing for logic devices.
Dynamic power is the power involved in switching process, right? So as you switch a device, that's what you mean by dynamic power. Static power here is zero because of non-volatility. These magnets retain their information, and you're either clock. I just went through clocking, so you're clocking these structures. If you don't clock it, if there is no voltage applied, there is no, you know, static power dissipation. There is no standby power. In CMOS, there is a VDD that is always tied to 1 volt. So when the device is supposed to be off, it's not necessarily off, you have leakage. But in these cases, since they are clocked, when you don't clock them, there is no voltage, there is no power dissipation involved in that. And I talked about dynamic power, the energy involved in the switching process, but that was a good point. So that one difference is that these are non-volatile, retain their information, and they are clocked. So there would be no standby power.
You have talked about how the signal propagates from one device to another device, the input device to output. But normally in logic devices, the input, the output of one device has to go to inputs of multiple devices.
Fan out.
And the voltage that is associated, you said it's 20 microvolts with the voltage signal. So do you think that 20 microvolts will be able to support a large fan out?
Okay, so 20 microvolt is usually what switches one magnet. Obviously, if you need to switch more magnets, you would need a bigger voltage. So that would mean that you have to apply a bigger voltage. Or, the other way in the two-pass switching scheme, one could talk about that. This guy. So I'm going to modify, by words, modify this feature. Suppose this were to send a signal to these three guys. The 20 microvolt would just switch this output by itself. So what's happening by these two pulses is that they all, okay, The thing is, with these two-pole switching scheme, we have these vertical structures on top of these guys. These are like big gorillas that are deriving these magnets. So they all put the, you know, these outputs or these data bits on top of the energy barrier. On top of that energy barrier, you would need a lot less energy or a lot less voltage. So with this, how, because the gain is delivered directly to all of these things, this is not really driving. This is not really actually, wouldn't be driving these guys. Meaning that it wouldn't provide you all of the energy. So in this case, since the gain is provided by these vertical structures, you will need a lot less spin signal sent to all three or four. Is that okay? So it basically, so when you're talking about, so when you're talking about fan out and all of that and switching energy coming from the input, one case is going from A to C. Well, you have to provide the entire energy. But the other case involves putting the magnets on top, which would require a lot less energy. And that's what I'm trying to say. Using that two-box scheme, you would gain a lot of, you know, you would have a lot of gain, and then you could switch more magnets. If 20 microvolts switches one of them from A to C, the 20 microvolts can switch a few of them, just tip a few of them to the left or right.
So don't you think this will increase your power requirement also?
Because there are two pulses.
Right. So because say if you have 10 devices in your connected output, you need to make 10 devices go to point A to B first.
You anyways need to do that, right? All these devices, I mean, any switch needs an energy value.
Yes.
And any switch for it to be switched has to go from this to the other.
Okay.
So at the end of the day, you end up providing that energy. The question, for fan out, the question is that does that all have to go from the same place, which is usually hot, or you know, all of them could have energetics of their own.
Okay.
So, in a sense, every single guy could be carrying a battery with itself, and I just send an information, and then everybody decides what they do based on their own energy source. Or I could be providing all of that energy. So that's the difference. But at the end of the day, you would have to provide the energy.
Right.
Yeah, you go ahead, Ganesh. Okay.
So two questions. In two-pulse switching, how do you ensure that the state of the magnet remains at B? Because there should be some noise there.
Yeah.
And secondly, keeping the magnet at B itself will require some energy.
Right.
Till switching.
Right. So this is where, okay, so in this case, the two pulses are kind of applied together, right? One question would be that synchronization. Well, one could say that the bias would be wider than the supply. So what I'm trying to explain is that one is trying to put it at B, but the speed signal in the channel is trying to tilt it either way. So the question that has to be asked, there could be some fluctuations here. That's what you're saying. And if the fluctuations, you know, put you, you want to be here, but the fluctuation dictates that you're here, so your situation would be erroneous. What has to happen is that the spin signal, in principle, needs to be infinitesimally small. But because there are thermal fluctuations, it has to be big enough that creates a big enough deviation from here, so that thermal fluctuations would not determine the switching. What I mean is that the spin signal has to be big enough to deflect this enough so that when you fluctuate around this, you don't end up on the other side. So this is if you're using these two pulses at the same time, all right? But if they are at different times, one thing that will give you is stability, meaning that let's say one puts it at B, and then the next signal comes later and switches. But then, if you put it at B, what happens is that, as you said, thermal fluctuation will just nudge it over.
Is there energy landscape?
Yeah, so you could deflect the energy landscape like that.
So you can engineer that energy landscape
Coming
flat?
Okay. What you can do is to have it like this.
Okay.
Create a metal stable state here. Use the clock to put it up there, and then the spin signal comes later to nudge it over. Either way, in the previous case, the spin signal that the transfer signal that provides the information has to be big enough to overcome noise, and in this case, it has to be big enough to overcome the barrier. But if those two were not the case, it would be almost zero, infinitesimally small. Now that we have to do it this way, it would be more. But certainly a lot less than what it needs to switch the magnet going from A to C, as you can see. I mean, going over this barrier is a lot easier than going over the entire barrier.
Related to this question, as long as you have the magnetic field applied, supply voltage on. In that case, I think that position B is just most stable position.
That is true.
So you don't need any energy to keep it at that position.
No.
This question was You need an energy.
So if the two pulses are applied together, it's kind of hot when it gets switched.
But what hot is?
So what's happening in this figure is that as I'm switching, this supply is there, so it's kind of always trying to keep it there. And then the spin signal just tilts it while, okay, one signal is trying to keep it here and the other is just trying to tilt it a little bit to the other side. So when the spin signal in the channel is trying to determine the set of this guy, the other signal is trying to keep it there, it's not turned off. If you have to turn it off, you have to do that the other way, you go through this, what's so-called biaxial and isotropic, which I just showed.
If I understood the question about the fanout, I mean, you don't have to drive different transistors with one device, you know? If you can make a inverter or something like that, you can put them in series with certain, like, width ratio and drive, like, thousands of gigs.
Well, you need to have a fanout of at least two. So you have some information. You need to at least copy it into two different gates or two different devices. And I think the question was, you know, if you have only 20 microvolts, with 20 microvolts, you may not be able to switch 10 guys. You would not have energy. And the way I would try to describe that is one, I had two schemes. With one, you would have to inevitably increase the voltage. With the other, you wouldn't increase the voltage necessarily much because each one has its own energy source. But I think what you mentioned about the transistors, they do that with width, right? They change the width, they change the capacitances. And they do it gradually, so that way they are, you know, increasing the fanout as well.
Mm-hmm.
Here, you don't need to design them differently at all. That is very true, because they all have their own thing. There's no difference in the sizes. Any other question? Two or three? Oh, you go ahead, yeah.
You argued that this Allston logic will be favorable in terms of energy consumption.
That's what we expected to be. Yeah. Today it's not there, yeah.
But in terms of speed or the speed of switching, will it be much better because there's some threshold for the time it takes to switch the magnet? So
right.
Can it be scaled a lot?
Yeah. So this is where let me see if I have a slide on this. Yeah, I don't think I have a slide. Yeah, I don't have a slide. Well, okay, so I have one slide that. Basically, where CMOS stands, the intrinsic switching energy for transistors are about a couple of picoseconds. Now, the best shown experimentally with magnets is 100 picoseconds. So it's worse. We believe it can be a lot better, but that's our belief. There's some theoretical analysis we do. So this is just analysis that shows the frequency of a magnet just based on its own internal field. So if how fast the magnet relaxes based on its own internal field. And it has a lot to do with the number of spins involved, and yeah, I'm going to a lot of. So yeah, I cannot describe these things, but basically, what the analysis shows, 100 megahertz is where the magnets could be, but with some proper magnet design, having smaller. So if I were to do it experimentally, what gives you hope for a lot of scaling is going to a small magnet, which have fewer spins in them, but they have very high internal fields that they relax very fast. Magnets people use today are very big with many spins and they don't have very high internal fields. But bottom line would be that they expect it to be somewhere on the order of same as CMOS, a few picoseconds or 10 nanoseconds, but that has not been observed. What is experimentally shown is 100 picoseconds.
Okay. So are you saying that scaling will actually improve the switching?
Absolutely. So two things are happening with scaling. There is, I wish I had that slide. Well, I have something, that's not bad. Okay, this is not my finding, by the way. In the spin torque field, everybody and his brother knows this, that the strength of the spin torque, okay, so this is this LNG equation, dynamics of a magnet, and then you have this term, this so-called Slonczewski term, which is not a magnetic field, but it's an effective field, it doesn't act like a magnetic field, but its strength, this is an effective. Its strength is inversely proportional to the size of the magnet. So MS is saturation magnetization as V is volume. So MSV is just the magnetic moment of the magnet. That's all that is. So this field, this effective field, as you can see, it's inversely proportional to the magnet size or its magnetic moment. So as you are decreasing this magnetic moment, your effective field is getting bigger and bigger. And magnets switch faster with bigger fields. But then you don't end up providing more current. It's just that the magnet is getting smaller and smaller. So it has something to do with this.
Yeah, about the leakage question, I don't think you would have zero leakage because you would have static voltage somewhere sitting in the chip. And the way to cut it by a pulse would be cutting it off by a transistor, right? And it would still leak in the off mode. Why? Unless you have a magnet solution.
So leakage power, so every transistor, for example, the CMOS.
Right.
Everyone has a VDD applied,
right,
all the time. But these devices, they don't have the clocks applied to them all the time. So that's where the essential
difference
is.
Somewhere
in the chip would be the case, maybe. But if I were to compare the switching scheme, this switching scheme would have zero standby power as compared to a CMOS, which always has a VDD tied to it.
But I think you have also a VDD tied to it at all times. Mm-hmm. But then how do you make the pulse?
Every single device does not have a, that's a circuitry that would drive you, Okay, so you need a circuitry to design those pulses, absolutely.
Those circuitry will leak from
that is true,
to your ground.
But the ones that are doing the computation that do not have a VDD applied to them. Every single CMOS has a VDD, every single transistor has a dissipation, right? Standby dissipation. Here, not every single device has that. Only the driving circuit, right?
If you had a clock CMOS, then it would be the same case.
Yeah, absolutely. If the VDD that is applied to the CMOS would be on and off, that would be the case, right?
But those still leak, right?
And if you have a watch,
dynamic logic also leaks.
Sorry?
So could you go back to your device picture? My point is, you have a D supply, right?
Yeah.
Misalignments would be fine. Okay,
No. V supply is also clock, right?
Let me go here. Well, maybe you could show the device picture. Okay, yeah.
Okay, so but the thing is, okay, maybe this is another point.
V supply
is not always there, right?
Yeah, it's not always there, but what does it mean? What does it mean? It means that you are cutting it off with a transistor. There is a static supply in the chip.
Right, but there is one transistor controlling many devices. You don't have a single transistor for every single device. That's not how this is working. These devices could share the same voltage line. So there is a voltage line. You use one pass transistor to control the voltage of this voltage line. But then not every single one would leak. The major difference is that in CMOS, every single CMOS is leaking, right?
No, I think it could leak for every device, right?
No,
it could
here,
leak from VDD to ground.
But the thing
one
is
one transistor, but it leaks in parallel.
So let me talk about this. Does a CMOS always have a zero voltage applied to it or not?
Right.
It always has a zero voltage applied to it?
Yes.
The VDD is always there?
Yeah, it's always there.
Okay. But here we don't have that, right? Mm-hmm. Is that essential fundamental difference understood or not? That for a CMOS you always have a VDD there, but then I'm not always having a voltage drop across the structures. That's what I was trying to say. So the difference is that for CMOS there is a voltage source to every single transistor, always.
Right.
Here that's not the case, you're clocked. So if I'm not switching these, what I'm trying to say is that if I'm not switching these guys, they're not dissipating any power. What I mean by switching is this, if the input, so if I have an input, I'm applying some voltages across this and I'm sending this signal. So I have to apply a voltage. If I have an output, I have to apply voltage process to receive the information. If the logic bit is neither input nor output, it's just sitting by itself there. I don't need to apply anything.
Okay.
So that's what I meant by zero standby power.
So you said in the beginning that Spintronics has the potential to reduce the dissipation by about a factor of 10,000, right?
Yeah.
So, did you try and keep track of the inherent energy which is needed in this scheme now in order to be still kind of resistant against thermal fluctuations and calculate the dissipation, the minimum dissipation which could arise from this scheme?
So, one thing is, So one, okay, when you talk about Fermat fluctuations, I guess two points come into mind. In terms of the fundamental minimum, or...
Yeah, because you still need this energy to get
yeah,
the
energy,
C.
Yeah, absolutely, right? Yeah, that was close. So, yeah. So that has to do why this voltage is essentially stayed at 1 volt for the past few years. Because this 1 volt is, essentially has a lot to do with the height of the energy barrier. Now this is for a magnet, but I'm just using it for a transistor as well. So that 40 kT has to do with thermal fluctuations. Because it could be 4 kT, right? But if it was 4 kT, your switch would be wobbling back and forth. And it wouldn't be thermally stable. For a magnet, that's the same thing. You have this energy barrier. If it's very small, the magnet will be flipping back and forth between these two states. So you would need to have at least, you know, however many kT's, x kT's, 40 kT's, 30 kT's to make it stable. And then that amount, you have to at least dissipate that amount.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot go below that, right? So, but then you would still dissipate that much. But then it's just that for the magnet, it's collective. All the spins we get, you know, in the case of the transistor, each electron is dissipating the energy value. In the case of a magnet, the whole thing together is dissipating energy. Am I answering your question?
But I mean, in the end, like when you have the CPU in the end, I mean, would it still consume 100 watts? Or would it be less?
Right. So that's like, that, okay, so that will require a lot more analysis. But the difference is that, the hope is that it would dissipate a lot less than 100 watts. But to get that, you know, okay, so I'm not giving a number for the as compared to the 100 watts. I'm not giving you 10 watts, right? I'm not providing that number. Because there's a lot of analysis involved. Because it, as it was mentioned, it turns out that one is the standby power, the other one is the dynamic power, and then there is a circuitry that drives this clock. That circuitry itself has its own dissipation. So there are all of these issues that, you know, would give you 10 watt or 15 watt or 20 watt. But the hope is that it would get a lot less than 100 watts.
But you would essentially still have that 40 kT energy to
do this. 40 kT or whatever you assign it to be. I mean, you could do it to 1 kT, but then you don't have a reliable switch.
Okay.
Yeah, that has to be there. Okay. Without energy recovering the skin. So, okay, in principle, on paper, in theory, you do not have to dissipate energy to do computation. That's not fundamentally needed. It's not needed to dissipate it. You have to spend energy, but you don't have to dissipate it. So for example, you could put a switch on top of this energy barrier. You would have to provide that energy. But if you could recover that, scavenge that energy, if you could recover that energy, you wouldn't have to dissipate it. But then that requires a lot more complicated circuit to recover that. So I have to provide that energy. Now, if I cannot recover that energy, where is it going to go? It's going to get dissipated. So this is what, you know, what I said, that, you know, if this is the energy barrier, then you will have to dissipate at least that much. And energy recovery schemes are not really feasible. You talk to these architecture people, it's a headache for them. You would have to have all those things, it's just messy.
Can you comment on the channel material? What kind of properties is
desired? Yeah, good question. So the channel, The channel is essentially an interconnect. I mean, by interconnect, I mean it's something that, you know, transfers the information from one input magnet to, you know, an output magnet. It's not a channel of a transistor in the sense that, you know, you're turning it on and off. So in that sense, it does not have to be a semiconductor, but it could conduct or not conduct. But it has to be spin coherent, meaning that, you know, the distance between these two for this channel cannot be longer than the spin coherence length of this material. Now, semiconductors at room temperature, a few of them have a few microns of spin coherence length. Metals have a lot lower spin coherence length, but at the end of the day, how far these two magnets need to be with respect to each other, well, it depends on design issues. You could use semiconductors or metals, depending on how much spin coherence length you want, or how much spacing you want from these two devices. The other one is mobility. You want to like to have more mobility because we don't have charge current, but there are still carriers going on. I mean, the spins are going on, traveling. So metal would have a better mobility. But between metal and semiconductor, you don't fundamentally change the operation of the device. It doesn't have to be on and off. The channel is an interconnect. It just needs to transfer the information. So anything that transfers spin coherently.
Won't metals spoil your feedback?
Actually, no. So, This is, okay, that's a good question. So with metals, all right. So with semiconductors, there is this problem known generally called the conductivity mismatch, which creates the problem of a spin injection from this guy to the next guy, to the semiconductor. With metals, there is another issue, which has to do with spin coherence length in the ferromagnetic contact and the normal metal. That also creates mismatch. And experimentally, this Van Wees group have shown that you get a better spin signal if you put tunnel barriers with metals. So it has shown that if you use tunnel barriers even with metals, you would have a better spin injection efficiency. But not for the same reason as semiconductors, for a different reason. Any other questions? All right, thank you.